Before, I just want to present you briefly. You've been also very active in both domains as a linguist and language educator. And you also have this social history approach that we all appreciated in your last publication about the history of grammar. The floor is yours, Simon.
Thank you, Karen. Yeah, because it's 45 minutes for that. Yeah, I think there are some points of crossover actually with what Richard was saying. Mine is a bit more about maybe school systems and foreign languages rather than English. But I do the share screen thing. That's okay. You can see that okay? Great. Okay, so yeah, this is yeah, two parts in a sense. One is I wanted to talk a little bit about how I see French in particular, but modern languages, but French is our main modern language, foreign language in the UK, until it still is, but it's hanging by a thread. Spanish is creeping in. So a little bit about the sort of chronology story of that as I see it, and then a little sort of interrogation about how this is the implications of historiography for researching very recent periods and how that's different. So this title, Within the Consciousness of Living Men, will become clear, hopefully. The interesting part about this, and I didn't actually think about that when I cited it, is that now with the focus on diversity issues, now we think more about the word men being a problematic rather than the word living, which is the purpose of the quote in a sense. But I only had that as an afterthought. Yeah, so history, I think most people here know a lot of this anyway, so maybe not specifically in the English case, but I think the some of the situation was faced in different countries. There's been this long-standing debate around why people should study language, and we had, you don't need to read all that text, it's more a reminder for myself, in fact. We started having chairs in modern languages. It looks like quite early, but in fact, although they were called modern history and modern languages, this first chair was in 1724. In fact, the modern languages part wasn't really emphasized in the way we would understand it. And it was also the point of this was really for training diplomats rather than studying as a subject, literature and stuff. So it's just to say in a way that there was a disciplinary identity crisis in a way from the beginning. Why should people learn French for instrumental purposes or for broader educational intellectual purposes? And that in a way is at the heart in a way of what we still the debates that still circulate around language learning in the UK, because of course we don't have the obvious need that other people have with English, for example, but even maybe with English it's problematic. Early 20th century, provision extended in schools and at universities as well, but I'll talk a little bit about both in parallel. There was always the take-up of languages in England has always been against the backdrop of our very rigid social class system and the aspiration, in a way, to have some form of social capital through a liberal education. As an aspirational model, even if it wasn't really on offer. This, I think, is much more marked in the English context than in other countries, certainly in Germany, for example, where there was a more tradition of vocational education was more highly valued, and there was more centralized delivery, both in France and in Germany. In England, it was very laissez-faire, very old school boy network sort of thing. So that allowed the traditional model, if you like, of grammar school offer to continue. Yeah, the Leeds Report, maybe some of you have heard about that. 1918 was the most famous or the first big specific government commissioned report to look into languages. And there we see there the reference there that modern studies and modern languages came under the field of modern studies, were always regarded as second rate and were often the source of some derision, even at top schools, at public schools, independent schools and at universities. So classics were always for the elite in a way, and modern languages could only be taken seriously if it competed with what the classics had to offer and present itself as a classic. We see that very famously in this professor's inaugural speech. John Orr gave this speech in Edinburgh 1933, and it's been cited by others, including Charles Fosdick, who wrote a wonderful problematic discussion of this. And he called French the third classic. In a way, he wanted to defend French, but what obviously he was really doing was in a way nailing its coffin as well, in a sense, because his definition of classic is something that lasts over time and is sort of, it's a temporal in a way definition, because it has to be something from the past. So it's sort of anti-relevance in a sense. But the reason he was doing it was to justify the importance of French for school and university curricula, the third classic, meaning not just the temporal thing, but meaning that it's foundational, that it transcends time in a sense, and that it's worthy subject. By his definition of French, of course, he's referring to the study of Pascal and the study of French literature and philology. In the post-war system, so coming back up to the period of the conference, in a way, the post-war period, there was, without too much detail about the specificity of the English system, it's very famous for us who know about the history of education in England, and I'm not sure how it compares to France, but this Education Act of 1944 was a real turning point for us. It established this tripartite system of grammar schools and secondary modern schools. There were also technical schools, but actually very few of those were ever actually founded. And this meant that the children took an exam at age 11 and the most able went to a grammar school. This was in a way an echo of what had happened before, because there had always been sort of technical schools and grammar schools anyway, but this was a national model. So this was the first time we had this national model of three schools, more two schools really, because technical schools can be taken out. In terms of the idea, of course, is that this is meritocratic in the sense that if you work hard and if you're able, you can get on. But in reality, of course, it just reinforces existing social divides, because grammar schools are peopled by middle-class children. But the relevance for languages is that it's really in grammar schools where people are studying languages. In the 50s, we see about 30% of children, but that's on average. There's regional variation as well. About 30% of children going to grammar schools. They're the only ones who are going to be studying French all the way through. Some children in secondary modern are doing some introductory courses, but they're not taking national exams in languages. So what are they studying? Well, just to mention at higher education level rather than school, and this links a little bit to what Richard was saying about applied linguistics in a way, there was a turn away from language study as purely literary classic model, if you like. And this was quite not famous, but it's been written about by Charles Fosdick and others, for example. This retort by Denis Saurat. He was a professor of French at King's College, actually, where I work, and also a director of the French Institute in London. And he was replying to a petition signed by a group of students from the National Union of Students who were campaigning against having compulsory philology in their French language courses. And so a number of experts wrote in this journal, Universities Quarterly, defending, in a way, the students' position and arguing against this very traditional classics model of French learning. And this is the quote in a way that I've used for the title of the presentation, saying the basis of our university studies of French should be the concrete fact of France's culture as they exist within the consciousness of living men. So the reason I have a picture of Pascal there is that in the text, he says, and I'm interested to know with the French colleagues in the call if they agree with that, but because he's writing in 1946, 1947, he says that even educated French speakers don't understand the French from before Pascal's time. I think it's surprising, but he says that. So you tell me if it's right. And so he says that the people are learning this obsolete French in a way, and that it should be brought up to date. So the French Studies Journal was launched in 1947. Sorat was one of the editors of that. I think it was Alfred Ewart who set it up, and a couple of others. Basil Blackwell as well, I think, as well. And that was to focus more on cultural, what we would now call, I guess, cultural studies, but more current and contemporary issues and literature. I mean, by contemporary, we're including there Proust and anything 20th century sort of thing. So that was a turn, in a way, toward a more contemporary vision of what content should be in higher education, at least. That's a school thing, that's a university level discussion. So back to school, we see these national exams introduced in 1951, O-level and A-level. We still have this A-level. It's like the exam people take when they're 18. Language in the 1950s, in the post-war period, is still seen as a marker, in a way, of a liberal education. Most children are still not studying languages to exam level. There is still the argument, as cited, as I give an example here of this Ministry of Education report, of French languages in general being justified, if you like, for providing the artistic and aesthetic training which mark the truly educated and cultured person. And they're arguing for a conception of modern languages to be as broad and liberal as the study of the classics. So that changed a lot in the 60s, which is in a way linked to the discussion of applied linguistics in the higher education sector. Because of course, everything changed then. In the counterculture of the 1960s, the whole perception of language and conception of our disciplinary boundaries changed. So in language teaching, that meant a big change to communication becomes the buzzword here. At school level, of course, we have comprehensive schools introduced. So comprehensive schools meaning that they did away with the selection. What does that mean for languages? It means that people now, everyone is supposed to be learning languages. So that not only is there a shortage of teachers, of course, and a shortage of material, but that also means that the traditional methods, if you like, don't work for most children. So they have to adapt the methodology. So at university level, there was this expansion of applied courses and applied linguistics as a new field. They were also, although Richard was focusing on English there, and most people think of English in Britain, I'm talking about when they think of applied linguistics, there were also a number of applied foreign language courses. I actually did one, so I'm sort of first person witness to it. I did an applied language course that was an applied language course with French, half English, which wouldn't exist now. So it was, and that was in the 1980s. This was very much of its time. So applied courses with foreign languages, with French in particular, I don't know if any exists now, but they're few and far between. Whereas there was a real fashion for them from in the 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s. And that was part of a widening participation thing so that more students, more non-traditional students who weren't studying literature and the traditional language degree in literature, these would appeal to them. So it's often used in a reductive way. People say applied as if it's something a bit second rate. But in a sense, the idea was to make it applied in the sense that you would do translation, you would do some machine translation stuff and computerized stuff as well. But you would really look at applied linguistics elements for research, but also how language is used in the workplace. So people with applied language degrees go into journalism and lots of different fields, applied things like that, not just teaching, although lots of us do go into teaching as well. So modern languages in comprehensive schools throw up lots of problems, and there are just highlights some. People learning French, but this is leaving with a shortage of French teachers. This is a government report, 1977, talks about the dilution of quality of teaching because basically there's a shortage of teachers, so anyone can do it sort of thing. That's the implication in the report. So very critical in a way of the way French is being taught in secondary schools. There was an atmosphere of boredom, disenchantment and restlessness in many schools, in many language classes. And again, even here, there was this anxiety around falling numbers, and that's a very current discourse. So I'll go on quickly here. It's easy for me to talk about looking back, because I'll tell you a little bit about my PhD research in a second, but when I basically did some life history work, some autobiography work based on baby boomers who were going through the system in this time. So it was easy for me to imagine that there was the golden age, but the word golden age obviously is always retrospective anyway. And I actually think that although more children from, if you like, non-privileged backgrounds were doing languages, the numbers were still relatively small. So we can't imagine that everyone was doing French and everyone was studying French and speaking French. The numbers were still small, but there was still, I think, more opportunity for people from less privileged backgrounds to be interested in and have the structural possibility to study languages. Now, of course, more people are in university than ever. In England, we were always way behind other European, a long way behind other European countries in terms of numbers. Only 3% of people at university in England in 1950 compared, I don't know the number in France, but it was higher than that, I'm sure. Tony Blair had set in the 1990s a target that at least half of children, young people should be in university or higher education of some form. And that's only just been achieved actually in 2020. So you see that there's been a creep up of numbers of people in university level, but numbers taking language degrees dropping massively, and actually other areas of the arts and humanities. So languages doesn't just suffer on its own, it suffers with other. And that I think is an international trend towards the instrumentalization of education and people wanting science and maths and technical subjects. So yeah, I think I don't want to use the term golden age, but I think there were more opportunities for people without paying university fees, for example, which I think you still haven't got in France in the way we have, but they cripple now and close down lots of possibilities, I think. So anyway, so there's a constant talk now about the crisis, and we always see the numbers. I think too much talk around crisis, to be honest, because I think it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, but that's just my view. Closure of language departments, especially in pre-92 universities, that means, how can I say, lower status universities is probably the best way to say it. No, I mean to say post here, sorry, post 92 universities. It means the former polytechnics, who were more likely to be offering the applied courses. So we talk in England about post 92 universities, pre 92 universities, older, more traditional, more attractive or more elite universities are pre 92. Try to be nice, use nice language around it. So I wanted to throw in some reflections about how we research differently when we're talking about recent very recent times. And in a way, I'm delighted to see this as a theme for the conference, because when I started to be interested in history in the last few years, and I owe a debt of gratitude, in fact, to Richard and Nicola McClellan for setting up the Holt Network, which really drew me in, I thought it was, I wondered about how we can talk differently about the methods that we use to inquire, in a sense, when we're talking about different periods. This is just some rough ideas I had about how, when we talk about historiography, we use different documents as sources, different types of sources. And I think there are implications for the way we construct knowledge about history through the type of sources that we draw on. I mean, obviously, we draw on the sources that are available. But if, for example, we were talking, as Richard was talking about, the sources he's using in recent decades, the questions we pose are going to be very different, let alone the answers we come up with, than if we were looking at medieval manuscripts, for example. So I think it's the chronology is not just a timeline of we focus on a particular period. We're talking about a different disciplinary orientation in a way, and different questions, a totally different framework in a way for the way we ask questions and answer it. In a paper I did recently, I was looking at a whole sample of different types of primary sources used in a range of historiographic publications. I think we can trace the history, in England at least, we can trace the historiography of French teaching, probably to Paul Mayer's use of the Manuel du Langage, but even then that was very much more focused on the language itself. It was a more philological orientation rather than talking more about the didactic use. There I think we still have to go back to Kathleen Lamley's pivotal work in 1920, this wonderful monograph she did. But I did a little analysis of the way it was framed. For example, she talks about during Tudor and Stuart times. No modern historian would use these terms in this way. I mean, to use royal dynasties, people would use early modern, for example. So anyway, that's just a little bit off point. But it's just to say that when we are talking about researching current times or very recent history, the historiography is different. So going quickly, to investigate recent periods, what do we have that we wouldn't have talking about 100 years ago or certainly 1,000 years ago? Well, the obvious one is we have living memory, and first person accounts are available, both of experts working in the field. And I refer there again to Richard, who's done some wonderful interviews of people with widows and trim and stuff like that, often at the end of career, looking back. And I think they're very important. But we also are able to garner first-person accounts of people who were involved in the process as students, in a way. And that's, in a way, why it links to my PhD, because I did life histories of language learners. I didn't really think of it as historical work at the time, but of course it has to be in a way, because when people talk about their autobiography, there are always the social landscape that they're talking about. If they're talking about going to school in the 1960s, in a way they're telling a personal story, but there's always a shared script in a way, and there's a sort of social landscape behind it. So I guess a lot of my work that relates to autobiography is interested in this intersection of the personal and social landscapes. And that also means the intersection of personal and historical settings. So when you ask someone this is just a fun cartoon, don't worry about it, but you ask someone to tell a story, they construct different story worlds, and each of those story worlds of their life is also a story world, if you like, of social history in a way. So I think the first person accounts can't be underestimated. And I've always saw, this relates to my PhD because she was a case study, baby boomer case study for my PhD, but I've sought now with my students and teachers I work with to elicit autobiographies in different ways. And I've written about that in different publications. This is a different way to express your language autobiography, for example. So moving on a little bit from that, just wanted to do a little bit of plugging before the end, is to talk about how we, one thing I think that we have to do now that people maybe didn't have to worry about too much 40 years ago, is to talk about the impact, this word impact, which rings in our ears now in British universities, at least. We're under huge pressure every time we do anything, including historical work, to talk about how we disseminate it, how we engage other people with it. And this is, I think it maybe affects what we do, or certain, because it's more than just we do it and then disseminate it. I think we have to think about how we construct the work in the first place with different audiences in mind. But anyway, the point is that I've been working, I think Nicola McClelland will talk about this a little bit more in her plenary, but we're coming to the end of it now, and we've created these packs for teachers, which is about how to use historical material to stimulate discussion around current issues. So the reason I mention this is because I think current or recent work cannot be separated from its engagement with the field in a way. So if you like, stereotype of the historian as someone sitting there preparing his material in the British Library and writing it up. In a way, I think when you're talking about very recent stuff, it's naturally, in a way, it has to be more engaged, both in the way you do the research and what you research, but also in where that goes, sort of thing. And then I thought I'd do a little flag on my last slide.
Yes.
Yeah. I've only had actually 25 minutes, not 45, Karen. So
but the discussion now.
Yeah.
We are discussing. It's 45 in total. So don't worry.
Okay. But then I want to leave time for Robert as well. So, and I just want to do a plug in a way, a shameless plug in my last one. Yeah. And that Karen mentioned, because Karen is, she's got the hard copy. I like it. Karen works, as you know, is based in Netherlands and is one of the series editors for this series. And I'm very pleased with this book, with some colleagues here on the call were contributed to, because it's an edited volume. It's not me, Simon Coffey, monograph. But we're going to be doing a launch on the 2nd of July at 4 p.m. French time, 3 p.m. English time. So please come along if you like, if you're interested in that, and you'll hear a little bit from me, but also from other contributors from the book, who will tell you some highlights of it in French and in English. So
I think it's announced also in the chat.
Thank you, Karen.
I will resend the call. You already have two questions, Simon?
I finished. Thank you. So there's some references there. Okay.